But do you have any other suggestions on when you have all new languages?
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, I believe. We do have a quorum. A quorum is checked in now. Senator Ress will begin with Senate File 357.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I have the A2 amendment.
She just called. We'll get that distributed. Sir, this is the first committee the bill has been in, so it's an author's amendment. Senator Sieben moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Bill is being in the shape the author wants. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 357 is a bill that will prohibit putting formaldehyde in products that are marketed and sold to for children in their personal care products. It's one of a series of bills sponsored by the group that calls themselves Healthy Legacy, and it just spells out the circumstances under which the chemicals are identified and then prohibited. So first of all, there is a definition section in Section 1 for the purposes of this bill to indicate that a child means a person under 12 years old. And then it also defines for this particular bill the term children's product. In Section 2 is the actual prohibition beginning January 1 of 2014 that no manufacturer may sell or offer for initial sale at retail a product that contains formaldehyde, including formaldehyde contained in a solution, or that a product that has in it ingredients that would chemically degrade to formaldehyde. The Section 3 is clarified by the amendment, the A2 amendment regarding replacement chemicals, so that those chemicals that are used to achieve the same purpose as formaldehyde might cannot be equally dangerous and destructive. And Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. And it successful here, it goes to a number of other committees. And I believe there are people here to testify, both in support and in opposition.
Thank you, Senator Ress. Yes, we do have a number of people who had requested to testify, and we're going to start with Kathleen Schuler. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Kathleen Schuler. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm also co-director of Healthy Legacy. Healthy Legacy is a statewide public health coalition. We have 36 members, and we're dedicated to safe products made safely. We have diverse membership that includes the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Learning Disability Association, ARC Greater Twin Cities, the State PTA, the State Nurses Association, et cetera. We all know that chemicals play an important role in our lives. They give us modern and convenient products. They benefit our lives in many ways. Unfortunately, we're experiencing the unintended consequences of untested chemicals in thousands of consumer products, including those designed for children. Our state and federal regulatory systems are failing to protect us from the introduction of toxic chemicals into our products and ultimately into our bodies. So the Department of Health has acknowledged the risk to children from 9 priority chemicals that children are commonly exposed to. This list was derived from a larger list of over 1,700 chemicals that were determined by authoritative sources to persist in the environment, to accumulate in wildlife, in food, and in the human body, or have been determined toxic to human health, meaning that our exposure to them puts our health at risk for cancer, reproductive or developmental problems, hormone disruption, or adverse effects on the brain and immune system. This list includes formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a chemical that has been declared a carcinogen by the World Health Organization, International Agency for Research on Cancer. It also causes respiratory problems, and short-term exposure can cause wheezing and eye, nose, and throat, and skin irritation. Chronic exposure can be associated with asthma and a higher risk for certain types of cancer. In one study that I think is particularly illustrative is school children exposed to formaldehyde became sensitized, and they had adverse symptoms like headaches, nose bleeding, rhinitis, fatigue, cough, etc., and they were correlated with the levels of formaldehyde that they were exposed to in the classroom. While all of us are exposed to formaldehyde from various products, we're most concerned about young children. Now, young children are more vulnerable to toxic chemical exposures because they have immature immune systems. Their bodies are still developing. This bill would eliminate one important source of formaldehyde exposures for young children. Although formaldehyde is not directly added to personal care products, there are scores of chemicals used as preservatives that release formaldehyde when the product is used. Quaternium-15 and DM-hydantoin are two examples. So if a parent tries to buy formaldehyde products, they need to know this whole list of chemicals to look for. That's really not feasible, and it's not right. Our products should be formaldehyde-free so parents don't have to worry. We found numerous products on Minnesota store shelves that contain formaldehyde-releasing chemicals, including baby shampoo, bubble bath, soap, and body wash. We know that safer alternatives for preservatives are available and being used by a lot of companies. Johnson & Johnson, to their credit, has committed to phasing out formaldehyde-releasing chemicals in their products by the end of 2013, and many companies have phased them out or not use them in the first place. But we need to make sure that all the products are safe. This bill assures that all products will give parents the peace of mind so they don't need to worry about exposing their kids to formaldehyde. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schuler. Questions from the committee? If not, Meredith Salmi. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator Osborne.
Before you leave. Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Schuler, questions on the studies that you cited. Was there any indication of any comorbidities or any other health concerns with the children that were involved in the study? Now, we haven't seen the studies. I'm sort of curious, with the children that had some kind of an impact, did they have any other health concerns that were exacerbated, or was that the primary reason that was identified was the exposure to formaldehyde?
Well, it was an epidemiological study, and actually one of your handouts cites the study source. And they, in epidemiological studies, they look at different factors and they try to single out formaldehyde as one factor. So that would have been factored into the study already.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schuler, so it's really the formaldehyde wasn't necessarily a primary cause, perhaps, but it could have been a mitigating cause in some of the health concerns that the children exhibited in the study?
No, I think the study determination was that the exposure to formaldehyde. Mr. Chair, Senator, it was the exposure to the formaldehyde that the study determined was the problem.
So the study specific, Mr. Chair, sorry. So that was the primary health impact to the child the children that were in the study was the formaldehyde.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Ms. Schuler, can you provide any information on what other states have done with regards to these bans or these types of pieces of legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't believe there's been another state who has banned formaldehyde.
So, Mr. Chair, so we would be the first.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. In 2011, the CIR issued a safety assessment regarding formaldehyde, and they said that it is safe in cosmetic products when used at the minimal effective concentration. And can you talk about the science behind that and if what you're telling us is contrary to what their assessment determined?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're talking about preventable exposures to children. We're not saying that using this product is going to cause cancer. What we're saying is that we want to avoid anything that can affect a child's skin, cause a rash, cause respiratory problems, and it's a preventive measure.
But, Mr. Chair, but I asked about, was there, I assume they had some science behind this determination. Should we not follow their assessment in what they've already, in determinations that the CIR made about formaldehyde?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure if we need to follow that. I think we need to do the best thing to protect children. So I think we can have a policy. There's a lot of companies that are already phasing it out because of consumer concern. We're just basically pushing the market to a level where formaldehyde is not added to products and kids are protected.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schuller. And I apologize for my tardiness, and if this was covered, then please inform me. If we talked about the logistics of how this will work, because we're asking a manufacturer not to replace a chemical, do you mean manufacturers within the boundary of Minnesota or manufacturers who intend to sell within Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator, this would be for products sold in Minnesota.
Okay, and thank you. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Schuller, does that include products ordered online and brought into the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would assume so. I don't know.
Senator Council, in terms of, I assume if you can't sell it in the state, online sales would be prohibited as well.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I was looking at line 1.16, and it just says for initial sale at retail. And I guess that's not clear in here whether or not that means a bricks and mortar. It just says at retail, so it maybe would have to be clarified.
Senator Rest, if you want to think about which way you'd like to go on there. Senator Sieben on that point.
Mr. Chairman, retail sale is defined in statute under the tax statutes for determining what types of sales or what types of transactions constitute a retail sale to which the sales tax is applied. And I don't think there's any special definition for retail in this bill. And the something purchased over the internet is certainly a retail sale, and it is it'd be subject to the sales tax if it wasn't done by an affiliate of some organization like Amazon.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to point out that I believe that this bill, like mine, that's going to be heard, is going to the Commerce Committee. So I would suggest, since it's outside the purview of the jurisdiction of this committee anyway, that Senator Ress looks for an answer and tries to determine that when the bill goes is referred to another committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieben, I think I just answered it. Yes, if you purchase it over the internet, it's a retail sale. And although I can certainly look at it further, it's my understanding that in a committee of original jurisdiction, anything can be discussed or brought up. So I'm happy to have the issue raised here. If my answer is not sufficient, then I'll look further into it.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, Ms. Schuler, I don't see any penalty in this bill because I presume Minnesota is a small part of our national economy and arguably a very small part of our global economy. Now, California generally leads the way on these things because they are, I believe, fifth largest economy in the world. And so when they say we're doing a ban on toys, manufacturers stand up and take notice. And considering the logistics, if someone manufactures a product for sale in the rest of the world and someone in Minnesota orders that product, how are we going to know they didn't mail it to them? Is there a penalty for someone who buys it and someone who sells it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, I've had this discussion with the Judiciary Committee. It falls under the default statute. When a penalty is not called for, it's automatically a misdemeanor. And so the bill will go to Judiciary if it's successful.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, will people be notified they're committing a misdemeanor if they buy this product? Will people be notified that they're committing a misdemeanor if they buy a toy with formaldehyde in it?
Senator Benson, it's not on the buyer. It's seller
on the manufacturer.
Is the one who's not. You're prohibited from selling it.
I apologize. I had the wrong side of the transaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Further questions from Ms. Schuler? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schuler, how does this really goes to discussing the issues with the manufacturer. How does this impact secondhand stores, thrift stores that will already have this on the shelves? Are they going to have to, if this was actually passed, would they have to remove the shelves? What would happen, and what would happen to them? Because they're not a manufacturer, but they certainly would be transacting these types of products.
The Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmet, the prohibition begins January 1st of 2014, and the burden is on the manufacturer to offer for initial sale. And if it's my understanding, if it was in some sort of stocks on the shelf, that this would not apply to that. And obviously, we would hope that they would, knowing the harm that it does, that they would remove the products. But the prohibition starts with the initial sale by a manufacturer and begins January 1st of 2014.
So, Mr. Chair, to Senator Resso, the product that would be on the shelves, there's nothing actually in the legislation that requires the manufacturer to return it or receive it back and credit back the...
Not in this legislation, okay. Senator Osment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, one final question, Ms. Schuler. Normally when you see some studies, we don't have the actual studies themselves, so I'm sort of at a disadvantage. It talks about parts per million or exposure, and you have a list of all kinds of products, baby shampoos, Disney shampoos, Johnson shampoo, and it really doesn't talk about the level of exposure. Is there information that tells about at what level the exposure begins to exhibit the health concerns with children and how much these contribute to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there probably is information. I doubt it's very precise. I could try to get that information for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schuler. I appreciate that because it may not be precise, but we're doing, we're impacting businesses and manufacturers here, so it does need to have some level of precision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to address a little bit of what Senator Osmick was asking. And Senator Rest, there is scientific evidence behind this. Again, in 2011, a safety assessment was done scientifically, and I know that this committee likes to base things on scientific fact, as we should. And their conclusion was that formaldehyde and methylene glycol are safe in these products when they're formulated, that the minimal effective concentration does not exceed 0.2%. So the science has concluded that if it's under this percentage, these are safe and not harmful. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Just as Senator Osmet has asked my witness for the reference to the study and the background material, I would ask the same from you, Senator Brown, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to look at the original study.
I'll be happy to, Senator Rest. It was a cosmetic ingredient review of 2011, and I'll get that to you.
Appreciate it.
We're also going to hear from Meredith Salmi. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Meredith Salmi, and my husband Tom and I became parents when we had our daughter Ada back in April. As Ada's mom, my number one job is to keep her safe and protect her from harm, so that's why I wanted to come here today and speak with you. So Ada's recently started crawling, and it's amazing to me all of the dangerous things we have in our home that I never noticed before, things like outlets and power cords, sharp edges, little bits of anything on the floor. As any parent knows, you spend your day chasing your baby around and keeping her out of harm's way. Unfortunately, there's a lot in our home that I can't keep Ada safe from, things that never crossed my mind before. Things like formaldehyde in her bubble bath, flame retardants in her nursing pillow, or bisphenol A in her food containers. Like most parents, when I first discovered that these chemicals are in products for my baby, I thought, that's crazy. There's no way there's not someone checking, double-checking, and triple-checking what little babies are being exposed to. And what shocked me is that really no one is checking. I can see Ada's physical development. I can also see her brain developing through her babbling, her smiling, and her curiosity. But what I can't see is the long-term effect that these chemicals might be having on her health and development, like cancer, autism, and ADHD. That's really scary to me. And so with every new baby product my husband and I need to buy, it seems I have to do a research project just to find the safest option. I feel like I need to be a chemist to know for certain if a product doesn't contain formaldehyde, bisphenol A, or a whole host of other chemicals dangerous for my daughter. As a busy mom, I can only do so much. I'm asking you to help me keep my daughter Ada safe from these toxic chemicals. Minnesota needs policies that remove chemicals like formaldehyde and bisphenol A from the food packaging, soaps, lotions, and bubble bath kids use every single day. We also need a comprehensive policy like the Toxic Free Kids Act that will assure parents that Minnesota is taking a hard look at the most dangerous chemicals lurking in our kids' products. So for my daughter Ada's sake, and for the sake of all of Minnesota's kids, I hope that you will support the three bills in front of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Salmi. Questions from the committee? If not, we have two witnesses who wish to speak with concerns about the bill, Mr. Hackman and Mr. Quillis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. In the committee, my name is Andy Hackman. I'm here on behalf of the Toy Industry Association. We represent more than 600 companies that manufacture, distribute, and retail toys here in the United States. We have about 130 toy companies that are located here in Minnesota and support more than 5,000 jobs. On Senate Bill 357, we just have a very quick comment, not so much in opposition. We've talked with the proponents of this legislation. There's some confusion, one of the definitions, in terms of what's in the scope of this legislation and what's not. We're looking for some consistency with how toys are regulated federally for definitions and what's in the scope. We understand the scope is not intended to be at our products, and we look forward to working with the proponents of this legislation to address those definitional issues. That's all I can have to say. Can answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hackman. Questions from the committee? If not, Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the time to testify on Senate File 357. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm going to apologize right now, Mr. Chairman, for this one and for the next two. You're going to kind of hear the same refrain coming out of me in my testimony. But right now, the chamber would say that we'd kind of like to see that what's going on the international and federal level as we go through and regulate these chemicals. Formaldehyde is regulated very heavily at the federal level as well as at the international level, and as pointed out in testimony so far, it has not been regulated to this extent in any other state in the nation. So I also wanted to clarify, too, at one point it was discussed that formaldehyde was intentionally introduced into the products that we're talking about here, and it is not intentionally introduced formaldehyde itself. It's kind of a byproduct of what happens, and it occurs when it goes into the product as a preservative as the product sits on the shelf. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, it's naturally occurring in the environment. It's in bananas. It's in apples. We have some concerns about it, but I've talked to Senator Rest. We've discussed them, and we're going to, as she pointed out, it's got a way to go yet as it moves through the legislative process, and we look forward to working with her to address those concerns as the bill moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Questions from the committee? If not, is there further discussion on the bill? Not Senator Sieben offered moves that Senate File 357 as amended recommended to pass and re-referred. I guess judiciary is the next stop for the bill. If there are any further discussion on that motion, if not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Eaton is presenting a bill in another committee, so Senator Sieben, can you go right now?
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 379 would build on Minnesota's past practice of banning bisphenol A in baby bottles and sippy cups, and now extend that ban to products that are specifically targeted to children. I should be more specific and say in baby food products and in food products that are specifically targeted to impact children. I'm sure, like many of you, were quite surprised to learn that there is bisphenol A in that is used in the manufacturing of, or that is used in the canning, I should say, of baby food products. It is found in the lid of the jar in some baby food products. It's actually Minnesota would not be the first state to enact this ban, but there has been very conclusive evidence, I think, that BPA is a harmful chemical to be exposed to, for children to be exposed to. It disrupts hormones in the human body, even at low doses, especially when exposure occurs in utero or early in life. And animal and lab studies show that exposure to BPA is linked with reproductive problems like early puberty and infertility, behavior problems like hyperactivity and aggression, prostate and breast cancer, obesity, and diabetes. So we need to, as I mentioned before, France, the states of Connecticut, Vermont, and Maine have already banned BPA from baby food jars and formula cans, and this legislation would build on that. Joining me today, I do have some testifiers. I also, before I forget, would like to move the A1 amendment, which would get the bill in the shape that I would like, please.
And this is the first committee the bill has been in, so this is an author's amendment. We'll wait to. Oh, and it's the same, just to the same amendment that the amendment to the rest bill was, and the replacement chemicals. Wait, I want to make sure everybody has it at least handed out so they can see what we're dealing with. Why don't you begin with call your witnesses if you're ready to go, and we'll move the amendment as soon as it's been distributed.
Mr. Chair, first I'd like if Dr. Toscano from the University of Minnesota could please testify.
While he's coming up, since it is an author's amendment, and so on, I will. Senator Sieben moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and then proceed.
I'm Bill Toscano. I'm head of the Environmental Health Sciences Division at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. So my concern with bisphenol A in young children and in utero are that it's an estrogen. It was synthesized as an estrogen by the same laboratory that made diethylstilbestrol, which had, as you know, tragic consequences. But because it wasn't as potent an estrogen as diethylstilbestrol, it didn't make it to the drug market. The chemists are very smart people, and once they have a compound, they figure out other uses for it. So we had the polycarbonate bottles, which were polymers of BPA. So when you give these in utero, when your people are exposed in utero in animal studies, and now there's a developing body of evidence coming about humans, we see mice, pups, born with high levels of insulin. This sort of predisposes people for diabetes. So this has also been associated with the obesity epidemic that we're also seeing in children. So I'd like to think of an example of what we would see if we're having all these estrogenic kinds of compounds in the environment. So let's suppose we sprayed the planet with estrogen. What would you see? You would see fatter kids. You'd see younger ages of onset of type 2 diabetes. You'd see younger ages of onset for hormonal cancers. You would see younger ages of pubescence. The question is, what are we seeing? We're seeing these effects. So these chemicals cause great concern because even, from birth to age 2, children are still developing very rapidly. And so there's a great deal of concern that we're altering their hormonal distribution and their hormonal function by giving them the wrong signals that will then lead to later diseases. And so this is where I stand with that.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to just point out to the committee and to members that there is industry action that's taking place in regard to the phase-out of BPA. Gerber and other baby food companies are using a polyester coating instead of BPA in glass baby food jar lids. The three leading formula companies have Similac, Enfamil, and Parents' Choice have eliminated BPA from their linings of their formula cans. But if you'll notice, this legislation includes a ban on canned foods that are targeted to children. So those are things like some of you probably have bought Dora the Explorer soup or Cars 2 soup that's sold by Campbell's. Campbell's has committed to phasing BPA out of their products, but they have not announced a date or disclosed the alternative they plan to use. So we think that the manufacturers are either doing this or are able to do this, that there are safe alternatives out there. And this, again, would just, take that next step and encourage them or tell them that they need to do that. And so with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Sir Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Sieben and the testifier. Question, you indicated that there was other states that have banned this. Which other states have banned this product?
So Connecticut, Vermont, and Maine have banned BPA and the use of baby food jars and formula cans.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And that was very specific to just those applications, correct?
That's correct. And this legislation would also include a ban on BPA in products that are specifically marketed to children. So, again, it would not be the way I think of it, it would not be Campbell's soup that is chicken noodle soup. It would be Cars
cars, not flavored is the wrong word, cars marketed, you know, with the Disney picture on the front of the canned food jar, where it's, in their case, I think sometimes called Healthy Kids formula or whatever it is.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so bottled water, I mean, we have a flyer here from the International Bottled Water Association. So it sounds to me like they're very concerned, and I actually was sort of curious about your reaction to the information they had in here, specifically that the FDA specifically carefully reviewed this citizen's petition and failed to find sufficient data and information to persuade the FDA to initiate rulemaking to revoke this product. I'm sort of curious as to what yourself or your testifier has to say when the FDA actually says that this isn't a problem.
I think that one of the problems with the FDA study was that it was called the question of who was actually assessing the data, and some people were paid by the Plastic Manufacturing Association, et cetera. So that called to question that result. And again, it's an opinion. It's not necessarily based on data. It's what we call, you know, sort of best scenario that they could pick. But the problem is safety doesn't mean anything. There's no such a thing as safe. But what happens is, what are you considering for children? You know, children are growing and at a very rapid rate, developing very rapidly. And so some of the studies that they do in adult animals would never show up in children. Some of the studies that we do in adult people also never show up as in children. So, for example, in the formaldehyde study that was talked about earlier, they were referring to adults. It's safe for adults. They weren't considering what would have the effect on children. And part of the problem with the way we do risk assessment is that we haven't taken those people into account, people who are compromised by some other disease, children in utero. So there's a big body of evidence that's starting to develop now called the developmental origins of health and adult disease. So the programming has changed. So if you start giving an estrogen or an endocrine disruptor to a child through something that the mother consumes or to the babies, you're going to alter the signaling. And the signaling is very tightly regulated. So if it gets these wrong signals, then there's a problem. So for us, you know, as adults, it's probably not that much of a concern. It's probably not cancer-causing. And if we're going to be obese, we already are obese. But for children, that we're programming them to be obese, we're programming them to be, to change their gene expression through these epigenetic kinds of changes, to be a diabetic, to have heart disease, to have hypercholesterolemia, and so on, as they go on through the development stage. And this is the major concern that I would have.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, I'd also point out that BPA is one of those nine chemicals that has been designated by the Minnesota Department of Health as a priority chemical in a children's product, which means that the Department of Health has reviewed the scientific sources and determined that it has toxic effects on human health.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Further, Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, how would this legislation be enforced in Minnesota?
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, it's similar to Senator Rest's legislation in that it would be incumbent on the manufacturers, I believe, not to sell these products in Minnesota. Just like when we banned BPA in baby bottles or sippy cups a couple or several years ago, as you'll see on line 110, no retailer may sell or offer for sale in this state a children's food container that contains BPA. So, or further up, it says that no manufacturer or wholesaler may sell or offer for sale in this state a food container that contains BPA.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I understand that, but who's going to have oversight over that within the state to make sure that this isn't happening?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I need some help from Ms. Schuler, perhaps, could answer that.
Yeah.
Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we helped pass the BPA ban on baby bottles and sippy cups. And a couple of years after the BPA baby bottles were supposed to be out of stores, we did a market survey, and we looked at several stores, including dollar stores, and we found that all the bottles were BPA-free. So it didn't require agency enforcement that the market, basically the marketplace complied with the regulation.
And well, I think, in effect, the Attorney General's office would be the one responsible for enforcing it. But I mean, the way something like this would work is if somebody brings it to their attention, they go pursue it. I mean, they're not going out there, and the Schuler's group may have gone into stores to check, and would have, I assume if they found violations, would go to the Attorney General's office for enforcement. But
yeah, well, Mr. Chair, my concern is we're passing legislation that bordering states do not have to adhere to, so it would be very easy to not adhere to this legislation. But if the Attorney General's office does have oversight over it, I would expect there would be a fiscal note that would be attached to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think that the idea is just like the state has banned other toxic chemicals in the past, the industry will comply. And if they don't, then there will be action taken by the state to that is appropriate. Furthermore, I can't envision a scenario where a manufacturer would purposefully try to evade the law that is passed in Minnesota, especially around something like putting it purposefully continuing to violate the law to sell formula that contains BPA in its lining. If that's something that Minnesota joins the other states that have already done it, it's just not logical, I don't think, to assume that a manufacturer would purposefully ignore the law if it comes to that point, if we can pass this legislation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Seaman, I'm not saying they'll purposefully do it, but there can be distribution mistakes made, being that the surrounding states do not have this law in force. And I would feel more comfortable with your legislation if I knew that somebody was going to have oversight over it.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Seaman, you've indicated that the industry is really being proactive in managing this problem. And it doesn't apply to all food products. So a mom who bought peaches in light syrup off the shelf and blended it herself, fed it to her child, there would still be this issue. And so I think the market is sending appropriate signals. Educated moms and consumers are forcing a change. But that being said, I would like to address Dr. Toscano's, if we sprayed the country with estrogen, what would that look like? What is the primary source of estrogen in our diets?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the primary source is naturally occurring estrogen. So a lot of it is from birth control pills and other things that get into the environment. But there are other things that are in the environment in many of the products that we use. So things like nonylphenol, which is estrogenic, which is in almost every detergent, so it's also into the water supply. Bisphenol A is another good example of an estrogen. Many pesticides that we use, atrazine, which I don't want to bring up here, but also some of the other pesticides like endosulfan are highly estrogenic compounds as well. So we're being inundated with not only natural estrogen, natural in the sense left over from our urine and cosmetic products that we flush down the toilet every day, but these other compounds which have an effect on the estrogen receptor. Some of them, these are low-level chronic doses. So all of these compounds are regulated by an intracellular receptor called the estrogen receptor. That's what makes girls girls and boys boys. Right? So, and the effect is that they are bound by these small amounts of chemicals. So if you increase the number of things that bind to that receptor, you may enhance the effect. So some of the chemicals are not readily metabolized by humans. So they will stay for prolonged periods of time on this receptor. Many of these chemicals are fat-soluble, so they persist for a long time in the body, and they continue the exposure over long periods of time as they slowly leach out of the body.
But Mr. Chair and Dr. Toscano, bisphenol A is, I'm sorry, I just mispronounced that. BPA is relatively efficiently metabolized, and they're finding that it's actually metabolized more effectively than they thought. Okay. And so I want us to be cautious about attributing diabetes and obesity to BPA, which is a small...
It's a weak estrogen, yeah.
In dispute binder to those estrogen receptors when, in fact, we are inundated with estrogen on a regular basis. It is they're having problems in New York, in the rivers there, with the sexification of fish because there's so much estrogen in the water, and that's not from BPA. And so I'd urge us to keep the impact of this in diabetes, obesity, heart disease, cholesterol in its proper proportion.
But the children are not metabolizing it as well as the adults. So that's why I'm not as concerned about adult exposure as the children's exposure. You know, we have liver enzymes in the liver that metabolize these toxicants, but they come on only as you develop. So a child who's 2 may start having these enzymes. A child who's 1 or who's in utero does not. And the other concern is that some of the metabolites that we put out as we metabolize this stuff could be worse than the parent compound.
And Mr. Chair, you talk about in utero. BPA isn't transplacental.
Oh, it is.
Not in large degrees.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I have done some breeding, passing through breast milk, but... There was some in fetal blood, but they weren't seeing accumulations in the fetus.
Those studies are looking at concentrations, okay? So they're modeling the concentration there, but they're not talking about how these things work, okay? So there's sufficient amount, because remember, an embryo, a couple cells, it's not a 200-pound person. So the effect is much larger. The dose is much larger than would be expected if you compare it to the adults. And this is my complaint about this sort of way we do risk assessment is we compare a 70-kilogram human man, typically, and we look at there, and then we extrapolate back to babies and so on. And it does pass the placental barrier.
And yes, but I misspoke. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. They didn't find accumulation in a fetus, so we were past the embryo stage. And I'm not trivializing this. But I want us to keep this in proportion to all the other things that are in our environment. Soy has estrogen impacts, and there's significant concern with young girls having large amounts of soy in their school lunches could bring early-onset puberty.
Well, the problem with soy, may I interject, is that there are 2 kinds of estrogen receptors. Mm-hmm. One is the ER-alpha called. That binds estrogen, the normal compound. The other is called ER-beta, which is presumably binds phytoestrogens. So the soy estrogens are being bound by that, and that's why we think there could be a protective effect for some tumors when they're binding to the ER-beta. So, for example, if a young girl and a young boy are born at the same moment in life and they take up smoking cigarettes at the same moment in life, the girl has a greater chance of getting lung cancer than the boy. Why? It's not because she's a girl. Well, it probably is, but it's not because she has more estrogen, but she has more of the estrogen alpha receptor, which is a carcinogen. And the boy has a higher ratio of the estrogen beta receptor, which binds to the protective phytoestrogens. And so the hypothesis is, it's not shown, but from epidemiology studies, it's proposed that it depends on the ratio of the alpha and beta receptors. So phytoestrogens can actually be protective. So things like in soy and other products.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was mentioned earlier that some companies, such as Gerber, were phasing out their use of this chemical. Has a timeline been given as to how soon or how long a period of time that is before that will happen?
Mr. Chair and Senator, Gerber and some other baby food companies are now using a BPA-free coating. I offer that as evidence that there are alternatives out there that are currently on the market or that are currently available. One thing I think as a parent that I've noticed is that, and just as the other mother who testified can also said, it takes so much research for a consumer to know whether these things are contain BPA or not. So once Minnesota passed the ban on sippy cups or baby bottles, I noticed even before that some companies started to, because of actions that other states had taken, companies were starting to put BPA-free on their products. Here in Minnesota, I haven't noticed that on baby food jars yet. But I would imagine that as the public becomes more knowledgeable, for instance, before they brought this bill to me to ask me to carry, I didn't know that there was BPA in the lids of baby food jars. I would have thought that, you know, sometimes when I do a cost-benefit analysis, I try to buy organic baby food for my older children, thinking that organic inherently means it somehow contains less potential chemicals that could impact my developing sons. But there's some organic products now sold in Minnesota in baby food jars do still have BPA in them, and some do not. So I think this is the type of thing where Minnesotans, if you asked especially parents of young children, they would like to have this off their plate as one less thing they need to worry about. It's already, as I've stated, it's already taken at BPA. There are alternatives to BPA that are used in baby food jars right now. And so that baby food is not more expensive or there's no, you know, impact on the price that we've seen. But there's no way, too, for consumers to know that at this point. And so I just think that this is a next step in terms of trying to reduce the potential negative effects that BPA can have on young children.
Senator Benson, you said again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there BPA in carpet?
Probably. I don't know.
And is it transdermal?
Can you get exposure? Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Further discussion. Ms. Schuler, you were listed as a witness on this bill as well. You came up to answer a question. Did you say what you wanted to say about it?
I don't feel like I need to say anything more, except I just will add, Mr. Chair, that Japan, manufacturers in Japan, can manufacturers have been using BPA-free cans for 10 years. So we know that the technology is out there, and we just want to push the marketplace so that we can at least have the kids' products that are safer and BPA-free. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, Mr. Quillis is asked to speak to the bill as well. This is a recycling project.
Mr. Chair, this is lunch.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, Tony Quillis again from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm a director of environmental policy. And I'll give you my spiel again that the chamber believes that a lot of these chemicals should be regulated on the federal level so that if we don't go chemical by chemical, state by state, it's really hard for our members to try and catch what's legal in one state, what's legal and not, and go through it. But that's my standard stock, and you'll hear that next for Senator Eaton's bill also. But I just wanted to go through and point out some of the things, and I'm going to apologize to Senator Sieben about halfway through this testimony also. But her and I have had some brief conversations about this issue, and I've talked to some of the proponents about it, about some of the concerns that we have. But BPA, as you've heard, is one of the most heavily studied chemicals in the world. And if you'll look in your packet, from the FDA, and if you look on the bottom right, it says March 2012. In that middle column on the bottom, it talks about FDA scientists, not industry, but FDA scientists have recently determined that exposure to BPA through foods for infants is much less than previously believed, and that trace amounts of the chemical enter the body, whether it's an adult or child, are rapidly metabolized and eliminated. And then one other one real quick, and Mr. Chairman, I hesitate to do this because I'm not a chemist. I don't know if there's any chemists in this room, and we could probably trade studies back and forth, and that's one of the issues that we have is that we try and do this at the legislature rather than letting people that should that do it for a living do it. But, Mr. Chairman, on the bottom, there's another one, Health Canada's updated assessment of BPA exposure to food sources, and it's cited for September 2012. On the last page, if you'll bear with me, it's just the last two sentences that say, therefore, based on overall weight of evidence, the findings of previous assessment remain unchanged, and Health Canada's Food Directorate continues to conclude that current dietary exposure to BPA through food packaging uses is not expected to pose a health risk to the general population, including newborns and young children. The conclusion is consistent with those of other food regulatory agencies in other countries, including the United States, European Union, and Japan. Mr. Chairman, what we're talking about is, as Senator Sieben pointed out, is the coatings that are the inside of these cans. And in the legislation in front of you, it also includes jars, boxes, and receptacles, including the lids. And here's where I want to apologize to Senator Sieben that before I started to dive into this, I told her that I didn't think we could do it. And she is correct. And so is Dr. Schuller, that it is being done in Japan. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to hold up a can of organic tomato paste that is on the back, says that it is BPA-free. So we are, as an industry, testing it and trying to go through and finding certain products on where it works. The problem is, as you look, there's different sized cans. There's different lids on the top of them. And the products that go in here are different. Whether corn, for some odd reason, seems to be okay. Green beans are not. I think that if you look at some of the lists that go through there, we found some seafood that goes through there. But not all products. We can't just find one product to go through there. And the research and development takes us to go through, try alternatives, and then these are on average somewhere between set to be 3 to 5 years to sit on the shelf. So that's how we test them. We put the epoxy on the inside or whatever the alternative is. We put the product in there, and then we have to let it sit. And thank God, is sometimes that I've been in this building too long and Senator Marty have had this conversation, I'm not the one that opens it up after 3 to 5 years and goes, ooh, it smells funny, or ooh, that color's different, or why is there bubbles in here? We've been trying to do it, and we want to do it. And I can guarantee you that our members are doing a lot of research and development on it, because if you're the first one to be able to find it, think of the marketing advantage that you have. And as Senator Sieben has pointed out, right now it's a different composition. This epoxy resin that goes on the inside is different than from what goes in sippy cups and bottles that we've taken out before. And I think we might have been the first ones in the nation to do that and set the boilerplate for that, and other states followed us. But now, as we've gone through and has been pointed out, it's also been done in infant formula and on the tops of jars for baby food. But those are glass containers, and then those are plastic containers for the baby food, and it's a powder. It's not a liquid. So there's different compositions, there's different products that go in there, and we're trying to do it. But essentially what you've done is ban these starting in 2015 in this state. And, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that in this state we have, as pointed out, if you'll look, I think Senator Osmick referenced the International Bottled Water handout. And there's a number of handouts in there. But just in the international bottled water alone, there's over 4,000 employees in the state, $52,000 average job, $3.5 billion total economic activity in the state, and they pay $181 million in taxes. And additionally, there's six can manufacturers in this state that go through, and they employ 876 people, $1.5 billion economic activity, and $56 million in state taxes that they pay. So keep those in mind as you go through. As Senator Sieben has pointed out and the advocates have pointed out, we're trying to do it. We've done it in products that are targeted at infants. But the way the legislation is worded right now, Mr. Chairman, and I've got some concerns, and Senator Sieben has pointed out that there's going to be a couple stops along the way, and I look forward to working with her. And I've worked with her before, and I'm sure that we can hopefully find an agreement. And like I said, I've had some preliminary discussions with the proponents, but you know, those are the concerns that we have right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, I do have some concerns here. We have two scientific studies. The first one that we have here is the FDA. And again, it says FDA scientists have also recently determined that exposure to BPA through foods for infants is much less than had been previously believed. Health Canada study, again, I'll repeat what was said earlier. And I'll read a sentence from the page 4. Based on the overall weight of evidence, the findings of the previous assessment remain unchanged, and Health Canada's Food Directorate continues to conclude that exposure to BPA through food packaging uses is not expected to pose a health risk to the general population, including newborns and young children. If we were sitting here talking about climate change and using scientific studies, we would be all over this. But because it's food packaging, all of a sudden now we want to reject the scientific study. I don't understand that. We have scientific studies that show that it does not pose a health risk.
Senator Brown, I want to just comment on that for just a second, because I remember a number of years ago we had a scientist from California who was here talking about endocrine disruption and sort of thing, and he did a really powerful presentation before Senate Environment Committee on pesticide. He was working on the study and the impact of it. And he had, there were like 12 or 13 studies saying that it caused serious health concerns. And I think he said there were about 20 studies that said no problem whatsoever. And he did a nice presentation, PowerPoint type of thing, and he said, you know, I tried correlation, because he was a scientist. He said, tried correlation. Was it depending on the species of, in that case, reptiles, frogs that they were, amphibian frogs that they were using, was it the type, dependent on the type of species they were using? No correlation. He shows what the correlation shows. There's no connection between which studies found this and was that. Then he said, well, maybe we should check and see if they were done in the field or in the lab. Again, no correlation. Then he said, maybe we should check who funded the studies. And what do you know? He said, bingo, 100% correlation. The ones that were funded by the industry, he said, no risk whatsoever. The ones that were neutral from the industry, every one of them said there was a concern. So one of the issues we have when you keep saying this, you got two scientific studies proving that there's no risk here. And I mean, I think you could talk to plenty of people who are very concerned about FDA, and I'm not going to speak for what's going on in Canada, but that they're not, that there are conflicts of interest here. And so I understand you're saying you've got some study that proves this stuff is perfectly safe. But watching this stuff over the years and how it comes around, I've had a couple of bills that would have banned certain substances. One of them, the copper chromated arsenic, the green treated wood. I remember the industry flew in lobbyists from all over the country to say how it wasn't a problem. A year later, they voluntarily agreed with the EPA to ban it, because if they didn't, the EPA was going to ban it for them. And so I just want you to keep in mind that some of the studies may have in some people's mind a conflict of interest by who funded the studies and so on. Just keep that in mind, because I know you've got some scientific studies, and Dr. Toscano is talking his evidence as a scientist, how he views it. But I just want to keep that in mind, because I'm sure everybody has studies that show conflicting things, and it's a point I
And I understand that, Mr. Chair, but I'm not seeing conflicting studies. I would welcome to see conflicting studies printed out and sitting before me so that I have something to which to compare it.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Schuler would like to respond to that.
Schuler, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. Yeah, we can provide you with other information. Unfortunately, the FDA determination was based on a couple of industry-funded studies by Thiel et al., and we can give you those citations. The National Toxicology Program in 2008 expressed concern for BPA on certain health effects. The Chapel Hill Consensus Statement, which is 38 of the leading scientists who have expertise in hormone disruption, determined that BPA was harmful to health at low-dose exposures, especially for children. And there is a number of studies that, for particular health endpoints, that compile all of the literature. They were all published in 2007. Since that time, there's been many more studies. Some of the results are conflicting, but the body of evidence, over 700 studies, show that BPA causes harm to human health.
Mr. Chair, again, I understand that, but none of that body of evidence is sitting before me to look at today.
Senator Sieben, was this packet from you the one that BPA plastics chemical found to feminize males? I mean, I assume those links are to the studies you're talking about.
Yes, Mr. Chair, those are some of the studies. We also have a handout on the health effects of BPA, which is fully cited. But if you would like a comparison of what the FDA looked at versus what other scientists are looking at, the 700 studies, we can provide that to you as well.
Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Semet, I just want to clarify something here. I think to a certain extent we might have gotten slightly off subject. Please leave your cans up. They're my prop this time. Your legislation actually talks to children's food that's specifically tailored to children and specifically in containers for children's food, such as baby food. I guess let's stick with baby soup food for an option. So baby food jars. So I understand that. I think we slightly get off topic as we're starting to move into adult food here. The problem I have here with your legislation is it is very narrowly constrained to just the baby food, because by the time my kids were maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 months, we were already mashing up things that came out of that can. My understanding, based on what you're doing here, if the can is labeled green beans and it comes off the shelf, that those are not going to be subject to the ban, correct?
Correct.
That, you know, after a very short period of time, my kids, it was basically, because I hated paying for the expensive baby food, the food that our children are going to get from 6 months up to 18 is not going to be impacted one tiny bit by this legislation. So I guess my question to you is this really, considering what Senator Brown has said, considering the other, you know, the other reports that we have, and considering the incredibly narrow band of effect on this, is this really a problem in search of a solution, or a solution in search of a problem?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, I'd go back to what Dr. Toscano said, that the largest impact where BPA has on children is when they're especially young. That's why you'll see that the legislation is targeted to children's food products to be consumed by a child 12 years of age or younger. So you're correct that if you buy a jar of can of corn and mash it up and give it to your child, if this bill becomes law, BPA could still be in that lining of that can. But if you go and buy Disney Princess SpaghettiOs, if there is such a thing, where it's clearly targeted to a child, by the labeling on the package, or if you go to buy baby food, obviously, or a Gerber's toddler packet, you know, where they have like the little meals, the little food products separated, that would clearly fall under this legislation. So, you know, I was trying not to get into it too much with my friend here, but this legislation is more narrowly drafted to be targeted to children's food products that are specifically manufactured or marketed towards children. And that was an intentional decision that was made. based on the research, I'd say that BPA especially affects young children, and keeping in mind that there already are phase-outs of BPA in children's products in some situations, in others it's not. And again, there are alternatives that are available, especially when it comes to infant formula, can linings, and baby food jars. And so, as has been stated, this is an attempt to move the market further in that direction.
Mr. Chair and to Senator Seamey, I appreciate that, but I have an issue with how little impact this is really honestly going to have. I understand your point on that the development phase can have more of an effect during a very narrow banded time, but when you look at going from 0 to 12 years old, the amount of time that they would, at least my children, I don't know about other children or children's parents, but how narrowly banded the time is that they're in that phase, that they're actually receiving mostly food that adults have, so their exposure is going to be fairly significant regardless of what this does.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, if you want to entertain amending my legislation to include all cannings and all food products, you know, I may very well support that. But I think that at this point, this is a logical next step to take as we try to phase out BPA and food products.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there was a remark made before that there's no studies and no chemical National Institute of Health or any other kind of studies. But if you look in this packet, this colored Healthy Legacy packet, there is a page in there that cites studies. One of the studies is from Kaiser Permanente that says exposure to the ubiquitous industrial chemical bisphenol A has once again been linked to decreased sperm health, this time in humans, in a study conducted by researchers from Kaiser Permanente. And that's that 2010. There's also on the back of that, it talks about a corn-based ingredient could replace BPA in plastics. A 2010 article here that talks about Archer Daniels Midland has announced that the chemical isosorbide could function as a replacement for the embattled petroleum derivative BPA. So they're the first to offer renewable corn-based isosorbides on such a large scale. On the front, they talk about BPA plastics. The University of Minnesota, Missouri researchers talked about the chemical found to feminize males. There's a number of studies. I think there's 9 studies that are listed on this sheet. So there is in our packet information that would show studies if someone wanted to research that.
Is there further discussion of Senate File 379? If not, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 379 as amended be recommended to pass, and I believe this one's also going to Judiciary.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I have an oral amendment, sure, I'd like to make to this. I'd like to comply with Senator Sieben's request and make some amendments to this to make it a full ban on the product. So on line 1.18, strike the word children's. On line 1.11, strike the word children's. Lines 114 through 116, strike the entire section. And that would be my motion to amend.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I would oppose the amendment at this time. I believe, Senator Osmick, I said I would entertain that motion. But I do believe that this legislation is a responsible measure in that it's a phase-in. If that's ultimately what Minnesota wants to do, then, you know, I may support it. But at this time, I think that it's wise to limit BPA ban for children's food products. And that's what I would encourage members of the committee to do, is to keep the bill in the shape that we have it in right now. So I would oppose his amendment.
Just to that, Mr. Chairman, my comment is that this is such a issue and such a dangerous situation for children's food, and the fact that the children's food impact of this is incredibly narrowly banded to a very short period of a child's life, that anyone under age 12 using a can of green beans is exposed to this from basically from birth. And if that this is an issue to that extent, that we should fully ban it. So I would renew my motion to amend this bill.
And Council, restate the amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Osmick, on line 1.6, we would delete children's. On line 1.8, delete children's. On line 1.11, delete children's. I believe the amendment was to delete clause 1. Mm-hmm. Delete clause 1, and then we'd have to make a few changes there. And on line 1.17, to just delete the clause 2, and on line 1.8, line 0.18, delete children's. And I'd amend the title accordingly. Just to have
members have that amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Sir Osmick, my interest in supporting something this would depend. Are you planning to vote for the bill if this goes on? I'm just asking because I want to know the nature of the interest in this.
Well, to be honest, Mr. Chair, yes, I would vote for it going forward because I don't think we should be throwing things that are not going to work.
No, I'm saying if the amendment is put on the bill, would you be supporting the bill as amended?
Yes.
Interesting. Further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Further discussion on the 379, Senate File 379. Senator
as
Benson.
Amended. And Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, my concern is with a marketplace response. And it sounds like there are some foods available. And so I would ask as this goes forward if you would consider, and I would let you do this at your discretion, and I'm not offering the amendment, but that perhaps something if a food product is offered for sale in at least one other state, then it would be available for sale here and there would be a ban on other products in that category, So, for example, if a manufacturer has strained peas, baby food, BPA-free, then there is a market substitute for it. It would be available, and then a ban would be in place. I think I know where you're going with this. I think there's a lot of stuff going on in the market. I just want to be really cautious about kind of deleting an entire category of food that has a marginal safety, I would say, with respect to the different availability of lids and linings and so forth. If they became available, I would like to have them in this market, but not necessarily ban everything else. And that's my only comment or request of the author. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, thank you. I'm happy to continue to talk to you about what that idea, how that would work. Again, I just point out that for baby food jars, some manufacturers right now use BPA-free products, some do not. And with the other types of impacts we're talking about with this legislation, there are non-BPA alternatives available in the marketplace right now or available for manufacturers to use. And so, I don't think that we're going to be excluding whole categories of types of foods that are available under this legislation.
Further discussion. Senator Sieben has moved Senate File 379 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Eaton, Senate File 466. Senator Sieben will take your other bill after this one. Senator Eaton, did you have an amendment to this, that you were author's amendment or no?
I believe there is an author's amendment.
Nope, maybe not. I'm just asking. I was asking, and they said they don't have one, so if you have one.
I guess not.
Okay.
There was going to be one, but apparently there isn't.
Okay. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you. I would like to, of course, move Senate File 466. And just briefly explain what it includes. This is about public health, similar to Senator Stevens and Senator Ress, only we are talking about the nine priority chemicals that were identified by the Department of Health and the Department of Pollution, or the Pollution Control Agency. They identified a number of chemicals, but the nine priority ones are what we're focusing on today. They are listed on that legacy sheet, the colorful one. On the back, the Minnesota's priority chemical list. And one of the recommendations from the study that they did was that we move forward on doing a... where the manufacturers report their products if they have these chemicals in them. And then we've also set up a process for removing those products or having the manufacturer switch the way they make them. I'm looking for the part. Let's see. We did mirror a lot of this on legislation from other states. Under Section 9, the Notice of Intention on the Children's Product Sale Prohibition, that was modeled after the Maine legislation. And then we also moved on to... let's see. In Washington State, they have more than 60 chemicals, and we modeled a great deal of this on after their bill. Let's see. So as we go through it, essentially it starts out with the priority chemicals. It does indicate that... trade secret information remains trade secret unless it is the to disclose that the priority chemical exists. And then the rest of the definitions are pretty self-explanatory, except on 2.35, the safer alternative. We have or priority chemical as defined in statute, so it would limit it to those nine priority chemicals. Let's see. And then in Section 3, Subdivision 1, we have gone through and identified the different ways in which we would... decide if there was an additional chemical down the road that should be addressed. So this is like forward looking. And on let's see, 4.24. This is an exception that we put in there that mirrors the Michigan language, which exempts products that are produced in less than 3,000 units. Like if, I think the example used for me is if grandma's making dolls for the church, she doesn't have to do chemical testing on them. It's this is for people who make smaller numbers of things. Let's see. If there's anything else I should point out here? I guess I would stand for questions at this point. The bill is pretty self-explanatory. We have this. We have the nine chemicals that we would like to be identified and disclosed by manufacturers of children's products, that if they're contained in their products, and I guess I would move for passage.
Should we have your witness? There's somebody from the PCA, I believe. I'm sorry. Shannon Lautheimer. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lautheimer. I'm the director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And the mission of the Pollution Control Agency is working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. Protecting public health from environmental hazards, particularly the health of vulnerable populations like children, is foundational to achieving that overall mission of the agency. The Pollution Control Agency is very supportive of efforts to enhance understanding of the presence of priority chemicals in children's products and to provide information to Minnesotans so they can make informed choices about the products that they purchase and use. Therefore, the Pollution Control Agency supports the reporting requirements that are included in Senate File 466. The reporting requirements are consistent with the Pollution Control Agency's and Minnesota Department of Health's 2010 legislative report, which is a report on options to reduce and phase out priority chemicals in children's products and to promote green chemistry. Now, this report was one of the requirements of the 2009 Toxic-Free Kids Act legislation, where the priority chemicals were designated under that by the Department of Health, and then the Pollution Control Agency was directed to look at options to reduce and phase out those priority chemicals in children's products. The report then includes a number of recommendations, and actually the first recommendation in that 2010 report was that the legislature consider actions to require manufacturers that produce or sell children's products in Minnesota that contain one or more of the priority chemicals to report that information about the priority chemicals contained in those products. This proposed bill, therefore, would require such reporting, and the reporting is needed to provide information about the presence of priority chemicals in children's products so that consumers can be informed and they can avoid products that contain priority chemicals if they so choose. And previous testifiers on the previous bills illustrated the challenges right now about getting that information, so reporting would help provide that information to consumers. The reporting would also provide incentive for manufacturers to reduce or phase out their use of priority chemicals and to select safer alternative chemicals or an alternate product design. So to sum up then, the Pollution Control Agency supports reporting requirements. It's very consistent with that earlier 2010 report, and we welcome opportunities to enhance the information that we have and that consumers have about the presence of priority chemicals in children's products.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, this is a major piece of legislation for the Pollution Control Agency. Is there a fiscal note that you have?
We do have one, but I don't have it with me as this is the policy committee.
They will have it by the time of It's been requested by Finance Committee. The committee will have to see it, and the fiscal notes will obviously be viewed there. So I know there's going to be one, but I don't know.
So we don't deem it important to see that in this committee?
We don't generally deal. I mean, you have a legitimate interest in knowing, is this going to cost something? You're not inappropriate for asking. I'm just saying that.
All right.
Mr.
Chair, one more question. On page 10, we talk about fees. I would have an interest in knowing what those fees are going to be.
Page 10. And again, often those are determined when you're going through the fiscal note and finance committee, of assuming the fees are meant to cover the costs of. Yeah, I assume that's when that would be determined. But
well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my understanding, is those were going to be determined by the Finance Committee, Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, I just have some great concerns that you're asking me to vote yes or no on a bill that I have no idea what the financial implications are going to be. It includes fees. I have no idea what those are going to be. That makes it very difficult to vote on a bill when I can't get those basic questions answered.
Further discussion? Mr. Hackman was wishing to testify on this bill. Mr. Willis.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I've got a written copy of my testimony here, so I can pass that
along.
We'll
get that distributed. Just leave it there. We'll have the page come pick it up.
Good. I'm Andy Hackman here on behalf of the Toy Industry Association. We represent more than 600 members that manufacture and distribute toys here in the United States. Safety is our number one priority, and we design and ensure that our toys are safe when sold to the consumer. As drafted, we do have some significant concerns with Senate File 466. We've had some discussions with the author, but in its current form, we are opposed to this legislation. For a number of reasons, this is an expansive piece of legislation. We have a very stringent set of federal regulations that address toy safety, the materials that go into our products, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act all have authority over the materials that go into toys. This legislation seeks to require reporting, but then goes farther to look at alternatives and eventual bans to chemicals that go in our products. I'll note for the committee, of the 9 chemicals that the Department of Public Health has already identified, 5 of those are already restricted by our statute at the federal level. So I want the committee to be assured that there is active federal activity on this issue and the materials that go into toys very specifically. In terms of some of the criteria that are in this legislation, when you look at a ban under this legislation, you have to merely have the presence of a chemical of concern with exposure, not whether or not there's actually going to be harm to a child as a result of this legislation. And when you look at the alternatives assessment process, there are a lot of resources that would go into having to do an alternatives assessment. In fact, the MPCA report noted that there are significant resources and expertise that would have to be developed by the agency to work with us if we end up in a situation where we have to go through an alternatives assessment. And then finally, I'll note in terms of some of the costs that we as industry see and we've seen in other states that have considered similar proposals, the state of California, through their green chemistry legislation, which is similar in scope to this, estimated that it would cost the state $7.3 million to implement a program that includes bans and alternatives assessments. The state of Washington, which has a reporting requirement, just the first portion that the MPCA spoke about earlier, the reporting requirement cost our industry, via state estimates, $27.6 million in that first year. Anecdotally, it was with Lego, a member of ours that's in Connecticut and has a store here at the Mall of America, and Lego spends per product $7,000 to $10,000 on testing every product. You multiply that across their product lines, they spend $3 million on testing per year. Before the Washington State program started, till now, they have not changed a single chemical that goes into their products. This is all testing costs to show both to the retailer, to the state of Washington, and nationally that we are not containing chemicals of concern in our products. As I said before, safety is our number one priority. I'm a father myself of a 4-year-old little girl. This is industry I'm proud to represent. We have a strong, stringent federal system in place to address materials and chemicals in toys. If Minnesota feels that we need to move forward with a reporting requirement, that's something we'd like to have a discussion about. Washington State has a program that's being implemented as we speak, but this legislation differs significantly from that. We need consistency, we need uniformity, and we need some predictability if the state of Minnesota is going to evaluate a program for reporting similar to Washington State. We look forward to working with the sponsor to try to get to that goal, but right now, as drafted, there are some significant problems in terms of definitional issues, and the duplicative testing costs that we would see would be pretty extraordinary if we don't get to the same page with consistency on reporting. At this point, we can't support a mandate for alternatives assessments and bans, but we would like to engage in discussion around the reporting requirements. So I appreciate the willingness that the sponsors had to talk to us about this issue. I appreciate the committee's attention to detail on these important issues. And as a father myself, I certainly understand the interest, the goals of this legislation, and we want to make sure that if the state of Minnesota moves forward, it's done in a proper way that provides some consistency. So,
thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to point out that there is a broad consensus that the Toxic Substances Control Act does not protect the public's health from exposure to chemicals. In its 35 years of existence, it has regulated five chemicals. Of the 82,000 chemicals in their inventory, the Environmental Protection Agency has required testing on only 200 of them. So I do not feel that the federal government is doing a very good job of protecting us from our toxic chemicals in the country, in products.
Senator Scalzi, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickman, I'm just so happy to have someone from the toy industry here because I've got two little granddaughters, 6 and 8, and when I try to buy them toys, I try to buy toys that are not made in China because I just don't trust their manufacturing processes. And you know how hard that is to find a toy that's not made in China? It's almost impossible. So I bought one from Sweden, and I'm assuming that maybe they have a different standard than China, but I could be wrong. But I'm wondering, so I think I heard you say that the Toy Industry Association tries to make, or I don't know if you said tries, or that you say that the toys that you sell aren't included are hazardous chemicals in those toys.
The Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act was passed in 2008 after a series of recalls in our industry. It was a wholesale change in the way that we approach toy safety. Every toy that is manufactured, no matter where it is, has to be tested, has to be traceable back to the site of manufacture, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission is the agency at the federal level that oversees that. That's different from the Toxic Substances Control Act, but there's been significant change to the statute that impacts our industry. It is expansive. It's taken our industry 3 years to really swallow the extensive mandate that came with that. We're proud of the fact that the Consumer Product Safety Commission is on watch, and that recalls were at their lowest point ever this last year as we went into the holiday season. And all of our toys have to be tested, representatively tested, against the federal standard that regulates heavy metals, regulates phthalates, and the CPSC oversees the Federal Hazardous Substances Act in our product category, and we are prohibited under the Federal Hazardous Substances Act to have any sensitizers, caustic agents that are exposed to children. So there is a network, and the CPSC for us is the agency that has the lead.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you tell us how many chemicals that Washington State reports on?
They report on 66 chemicals.
Senator Scalzi.
And ours is 9. So if they're already reporting on those chemicals, why does it cost more here?
Because the definitions right now are different in the way that this bill is drafted than the definitions in Washington State. We would need consistency on those definitions and the reporting structure. It's phased in by exposure in Washington State. It's phased in by the size of a company. So that's one thing that we're looking for. But more so, the retailer requires of us a certificate that says, or testing that says, you can sell this in Minnesota, you can sell this in all 50 states. So when Target orders Barbie from Mattel, they want to be they want to ensure that it can be sold here. So when there's those differences in the statute and whether or not you need to report it as a contaminant or as intentionally added, that's where the additional testing cost comes, because Lego or Mattel have to run an entire new set of tests where the, when there's inconsistencies between the two requirements. If they were 100% consistent, and if the agency were willing to work with us on consistent filing, that would help eliminate any cost and would provide predictability. So we're not saying no in terms of reporting. We're saying let's make it consistent. Let's eliminate the need to test for the same thing twice because there's some inconsistencies in definitions.
So am I hearing you say that that's the only problem you have with this is the inconsistencies in the definitions?
In terms of the reporting requirement, we have concerns with the ban, the alternatives assessment approach, and whether or not the state has the expertise and the resources at this point to implement an expansive program like that. The state of California looked at an alternatives assessment or is looking at alternatives assessment structures and bans, and they're looking at $7.3 million to create the infrastructure to evaluate those. It's a matter of putting the state basically in the R&D of a company, and we want to make sure that it's done properly, and we just don't know yet if that's a capability. I'll defer to the agency to say whether or not they have the resources, but we do have those concerns about that provision of the bill. In terms of the reporting, I think we can get there and have had good discussions about that.
Senator Benson.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I have nothing for these testifiers. They're just general questions on the bill, so I'll defer. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand this is policy committee, but I'll ask a more general question. Senator Eaton, can you give me a ballpark figure on what this is going to cost the PCA to have oversight and enforcement of this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I have not seen the fiscal note. We've been adapting this legislation as we've worked on it and gone over it. And I think we were waiting to see. I expect there to be some changes in the health care committee, and we'll be going to commerce and judicial. And so I'm not aware of the cost.
The Council of Fiscal Note has been requested, but it's not there yet. So, and unless the PCA spokesperson had any knowledge or anything. I'll assume that we won't know until the fiscal note. Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank Mr. Hackman for his experience and expertise, because I know he's got to get out of here, and he's been all over the country testifying on this type of legislation. So I just wanted to thank him and let him go. Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, I'm Tony Quillis, the Director of Environmental Policy from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and just wanted to echo Mr. Hackman's comments. I've had some very preliminary discussions with the proponents and Senator Eaton, and we just, we'd like to see it done on the federal level. Senator Dibble and I have had some conversations about TSCA over the years and whether Representative Waxman was going to. It's almost 3-4 years ago we talked about that, and I think Senator Laufenberg now has got some legislation to try and update that, and hopefully this is the year we'd like to see that done. But, again, we'd like to try and get through some of the we think that there is we don't want to, recreate the wheel here, if you will, get rid of the redundancies, some, conflicting, confusing, and costly reports. We just want to make sure and work through that as this goes through the process with Senator Eaton to make sure that where we're at in terms of the definitions, try and clarify some of the costs. As you can imagine, open numbers for fines and fees for the business industry is of great concern, and we look forward to the fiscal note as it moves through the process, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Questions from the committee? Is there anybody else in the audience who I missed who wanted to speak to the bill? Not further discussion. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Section 3 of the bill. First of all, I'm astonished at the sheer amount of bureaucracy that we're probably building at the PCA, but I'm going to need some help understanding this. Council might be able to explain. By deleting the "and," how broadly are we looking in the field of toxic chemicals? If either the author or Senate Council can help me understand that.
I believe they're listed there.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, by deleting the "and," it means that basically any of these criteria could be used. It would increase the size of what could be designated a chemical of high concern. Under the current law, it has to both be high production and meet one or more of those other terms. But now it could be just a high production volume, or it could be 2, 3, or 4, any of those categories. So by deleting the "and" there, you pick up the "or" on line 3.17, and it means that if any one of those triggers happens, then it can be on this list.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Knopp, so that would mean no matter how small the production is, the PCA could be looking at it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that's my understanding.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, is it your intent to broaden it to that extent, or if the department can help?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Daniel Andreessen. Represent the Healthy Legacy Coalition. To kind of step back a little bit about the provision in this section, Senator. So for the Department of Health to classify a priority chemical, it first has to meet a criteria to become a chemical of high concern, and that is defined on page 2, starting on line 2.7. So a chemical first has to be defined as a chemical of high concern, and then to make it to the priority chemical list, it then has to meet the criteria that's in Section 3. The reason for the change is that there are some chemicals that are no longer in high production but still have toxic properties, and so we just wanted to make sure we capture those chemicals and allow the agencies to look at those chemicals.
So,
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm wondering how big this population is going to be. There was a reason for the "and" at one point, and I'm guessing it was to limit the scope of department investigation to just those things that were high volume and were a chemical of high concern, so that there could be focus on those things that are most likely to impact the population.
Senator Eaton, I guess the question would be, I suppose, if you want to hit any high production volume chemical or just the 2, 3, and 4, I presume. In other words, you could delete the high volume. In other words, I'm just saying if you deleted clause 1, you would be able to get any of 2, 3, and 4. Are you trying to get high volume chemicals even if they're not in those categories right now?
Mr. Chair, the idea was that it's not to expand the high concern list, but to just allow the agency's ability to look at chemicals that are maybe no longer in high production but still have toxic properties and they're being used in products.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, we could eliminate Section 1 because high production is no longer the key criteria. It's any chemical that is on the chemical of high concern list, and meets any of the 2, 3, or 4 criteria. I guess I'm concerned at how big the department is, how much time the department's going to be spending on this if we eliminate the high volume criteria. Because the high volume criteria probably eliminates a subset of the chemical of high concern population.
Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chair, Senator, The list of criteria for priority chemicals are just a proxy for exposure. So the fact that something's high production volume means that there's a lot of it being used in products. So that's just one of many criteria. As Dan said, because some chemicals are under, it's like 1 million pounds per year production, they're still used in a lot of products. So we wanted to make it one of many criteria that reflects children's exposures to everyday consumer products.
So, Mr. Chair,
Benson.
Then it's the intent of the Healthy Legacy Coalition to make this as broad as possible.
Issue.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that the real intent is to use common sense to keep toxic chemicals away from our children. It's a Toxic Free Kids Act. We want to make sure that if there are toxic chemicals in any products that children use, that the parents are aware and can make decisions about that, and we can protect them from that. I just see this as a common sense approach.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I'll just move on. The public data section, the trade secret versus public data. Trade secrets are defined at the federal level, I believe, in the Uniform Commercial Code. Do we have the authority, having not sat on a Commerce Committee, I don't know if we have the authority to make public things that are federally defined as a trade secret?
Senator Benson, I assume because that's our Data Practices Act and we already do the classification, I think this is just, I think that's just a data practices question whether you want to do it or not.
Mr. Chair, this bill is going to judiciary, and we plan on working those issues out there.
Mr. Chair, Benson. But trade secret is a term of art. I also believe it's a term of law. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is saying it's your trade secret, but in Minnesota, it's going to be public information. And so I think there's significant work to do in that area. Probably my final question. Is there a national movement organization who's working on these bills? Senator Eaton, I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I am not aware if there's a national coalition. I know that I've been working with these people in Healthy Legacy here on, are you national?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a national group called the Safer States. And so one of the benefits of working on these chemicals in this framework is Maine and Washington have all 9 of our priority chemicals on their lists, and they've already done a lot of work. So our state agencies can benefit by that work. And it actually will reduce the cost to our state because we're cooperating with other states and we're trying to make things uniform, which actually will help the industries as well.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, so is Maine's bill very similar to ours? Because I understand Washington State's is not.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the frameworks are similar. Some of the details as far as reporting requirements are slightly different. They both have longer lists. The main list is 49 chemicals. Washington has 66 chemicals, and we have 9 so far.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this idea didn't originate from our PCA. It originated from an outside group. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, this bill comes from the study that was commissioned called the Toxic Free Kids Act, and it's legislation that required a study by the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency to work together to identify toxic chemicals.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton. I just wanted to make sure there weren't national organizations coming in and directing policy in the
this
state.
This is the result of our study, Senator
thank
Benson.
You.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, I want to go back to a question that Senator Benson was asking. We're talking about more than 9 chemicals here. Can you give me a number on just how many chemicals will be affected by this legislation?
Currently 9.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, you're changing the word, the high volume. Currently, it's high volume and another identifying characteristic, and we're changing it to or another characteristic. So that truly does broaden the list. I would like to know how many chemicals we're really talking about.
I'm looking for, oh. Over time, if the agencies, if there's a chemical of high concern comes to the attention of the agencies, they'd be identified on the basis of credible scientific evidence by state, federal, or international agency as being known or suspected with a high degree of probability to cause all the harms listed under 2.10. And so it just basically gives permission to add chemicals in the future.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I understand that. I'm just asking for, give me a ballpark figure on what that number is going to look like in the future. Because it truly is going beyond the nine that are listed.
All I can tell you is I know that there are 82,000 chemicals in the Toxic Substance Control Act that they have in inventory, and I do not know how many of those would be in children's products.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll ask my last question to the, I forget your name, sir.
Daniel.
Daniel. Potentially, could we be looking at 82,000 chemicals?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, your question about what this piece of legislation is doing right now, it's addressing the nine chemicals that are currently on the priority chemical list. This list is a living list that could be changed in the future. Right now we don't, we're looking at just trying to work on the nine chemicals that are currently on the list.
I gather of the, without the and in there, there might be, of the 82,000, it might only be 50,000 of them or so. But in other words, they're looking, they are already able to look at 50,000 or so, and they've come up with nine priorities. And they could, presumably with more, they could come up with more from that. Yep. And they could come up with more if we change the law or not.
And Senator, Mr. Chair, Senators, there are 1,750 chemicals on the high concern list. So, that number is not going to increase.
Further questions, and were there any other witnesses who wished to speak to the bill? If not, further discussion on Senator Eaton's bill. If not, Senate file, Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 466 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. I think you have lots of stops, but I think Judiciary is the one that. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Sieben.
Sorry.
Senate file 215.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate file 215 is hopefully much simpler than the last bill I presented. It came to me at the request of Washington County. Washington County is the only county that elects their county soil and water conservation supervisors by district and or by commissioner district. And there's a discrepancy between the redistricting schedule for their soil and water conservation supervisors and their county commissioners. And so this bill simply will address that discrepancy. Joining me today to answer questions and talk more about it is Jennifer Wagenius, who's the director of the Department of Property Records and Taxpayer Services for Washington County.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senators, as Senator Sieben indicated, there is a provision in statute that allows soil and water conservation to elect districts by supervisors by district rather than at large. This is an optional form of government, and the Washington County Soil and Water Conservation District is the only conservation district at this time that has chosen that provision and adopted that provision. During the 2012 redistricting process, we discovered that the timelines were inconsistent, and it's important for us to keep those timelines consistent for administration of elections and for our constituents to understand that with their voting locations and who they're voting for. It will make it much easier for them. In order to achieve the consistency for the redistricting just completed, we had to move up our redistricting deadline by a week, and it's our goal to achieve consistency in these statutes. We've had conversation with the Soil and Water Conservation District and with the Secretary of State's office regarding this change and adjustment, and there's been no opposition.
And, Ms. Lucchini, is every other county, the Soil and Water Conservation District, well, they all have districts, but they're all elected at large in the county despite the district. Is that every other one that you're the only one that does this?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. The Washington County Soil and Water District is the only Soil and Water District that has adopted that optional form of government.
I'm surprised others haven't, but anyway, any discussion on the legislation? Any questions? If not, Senator Sieben, does this go to your committee?
Correct, to rules.
To rules. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 215 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
It is, with that, this meeting is adjourned. It's always been kind of strange that every other county.